Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The clock is ticking. Time is running out. And if the House Republicans refuse to vote for the Senate bill, or even allow it to come up for a vote, taxes will go up in 11 days.
This is a system that our founders gave us. It's as old as our nation and as clear as the Constitution. Our House GOP negotiators are here and ready to work with our counterparts in the Senate to resolve the differences as quickly as possible.
As we deck the halls with gridlock and polarization, with us now is former Republican Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, better known these days as the Simpson in Simpson Bowls. The big bipartisan deficit reduction and tax reform plan released last year that Washington has also failed to enact. Senator Simpson, it's been a few years. It's very nice to have you back on WNYC.
Indeed, and I remember doing that years ago. I'm now known, too, as a benign curmudgeon, which is a ghastly appellation when you think of it.
And more than that, because you were trying to get something done with this bipartisan plan. But there they go again at the Christmas break. The House and Senate can't even agree on a two-month Band-Aid extending the payroll tax cut. House Republicans can't even agree with Senate Republicans, who mostly voted for the two-month extension. What are you thinking as you watch gridlock slow things to a crawl?
Well, I'm thinking I should feel charitable because Christmas is coming, but when you think of Congress, you just can't be charitable. Doesn't matter who's running what shop or what's going on, but to think that our country is laboring this way at this time of goodwill, where people, there is no goodwill between Democrats and Republicans, and people are, they're not angry anymore, they're disgusted. But let me just say to you, there's one little nugget laying back in the weeds here. Wait till they do the payroll tax cut, and they'll keep it at 4.2, maybe even take it to 3.1 a little later. Guess what happens when they try to put it back to where it was? Things will get a little better. They'll say, now we've got to take the payroll tax back to 6.2. That will be described by the detractors as a tax increase, and they probably won't get it done. And guess what happens? It destroys the solvency of the Social Security system. I mean, you know, the drinks are on me if anybody can't understand all this.
Talk about a catch-22, since the payroll tax is specifically what funds Social Security, and Social Security is one of the things that's specifically driving the potential deficit.
But it is separate. We're just trying to always say that we're trying to restore solvency. If you can't raise the retirement age to 68 by the year 2050, because the AARP is just scratching themselves and saying that everybody's going to perish. And I mean, it's a monstrous situation, but the Social Security system, by doing nothing with the 6.2 in its stream of resources, in the year 2036 will pay out 23% less. And what do we hear from the AARP and the protectors of the system? Nothing.
And you wrote an op-ed this month urging people, the next time they hear a member of Congress say they can fix the deficit without harming precious Social Security, precious Medicare, or the precious armed forces, you should look that member of Congress in the eye and say a word I can't say on the radio that begins with bull.
Well,
you can't say it either.
No, I'm not going to because you've told me not to.
But
no,
you think ahead. Congress is still trying to BS us about what they can save?
Sure. I mean, I was in that game for 18 years. I loved it. I did. I cherished the friendships with those on the other side. You have a situation now where the House has called for conferees. I know this is inside baseball. It means we're appointing conferees. There won't be any Democrats on it, I don't think. And then we want to negotiate with the Senate between a year and 2 months. The Senate isn't going to buy that, not when 37 Republicans or so voted for this minimal two-month extension. I mean, it's Zooland. It really is.
Listeners, your chance to talk to Alan Simpson from Simpson Bowles, and maybe you know him from the rest of his work when he was in the Senate. And we're going to, with his permission, we'll ask him to reminisce a little bit on a couple of things toward the end of the segment, like what it was like being in the Senate when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. But if you want to talk to Alan Simpson, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You know, I heard George Will say the other day that gridlock is actually functional government, not dysfunctional government, because the people of America are so polarized. So the members of Congress are doing their jobs as elected representatives. How much do you agree with that?
Well, I've always said that, you know, there's the same number of lightweight screwballs and boobs in your city council or your church or your business, and you have to have those people represented in Congress. That's been my view for decades. I just say that, look, where did this stuff come? Where did the lack of civility come from? You know, all of this stuff, and I think there's a very serious element of what George is saying, because look at your own city council. Look at New York. Look at your legislature. What's happening there? I mean, the chaos at Albany is known well in Cheyenne. We're a global system of dysfunctional operating governments who legislate in a chaos of the extreme right and the extreme left, and the people in the middle are exhausted and wondering where the hell to turn.
So is Albany now a shining example of breaking through gridlock with the recent Cuomo plan? Have you been following that?
Well, I know his old man well. Mario and I are old friends, and I admire what he's doing, the son. I think he's doing a lot of outreach, and I think more Democrats and some Republicans should pay attention as to how he's trying to do the outreach, which is so Americans are so thirsty for.
Rick in Rockaway Park, you're on WNYC with former Senator Alan Simpson. Hello.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Hello there.
I just wanted to ask the senator why the compromise that he and Bowles came up with would eliminate the mortgage interest tax deduction. And wouldn't something like that hurt the middle class and devastate the already weak housing market?
Well, I'll tell the gentleman that if everybody doesn't have skin in the game, nothing will work. When we went into this thing and found $1 trillion, $100 billion worth of tax expenditures, including that one, and all without oversight, nothing in it at all, we just said, let's get rid of all 180 of them and give the people what they've been crying for. Broader tax base, lower the rates. We said, if we do that, we'll take $1 trillion, we won't blow it, we'll take it to the tax code and we'll say, between 0 and 70,000, you pay 8%. Between 70,000 and 210, you pay 14% income tax. Everything over that is 18, and take the corporate rates to 26 and 36 with a territorial type of tax where you can bring the money back. But here's what we said. We didn't get rid of it. We said, don't leave it at $1 million. What the hell is $1 million for home mortgage interest, especially people using it on second homes or resorts? And we said, take it down, then give 12.5% non-refundable tax credit, and that helps the little guy. So I always tell people, when everything else fails, read the damn report. It's only 67 pages, and it's in English.
Rick, thank you. And really, the Simpson-Bowles plan touched every third rail on every subway line in Washington, raising the Social Security eligibility age, ending or transforming, as you just described, the deduction on home mortgages, making veterans pay into the VA health system, eliminate subsidized student loans for college. I mean, never mind the bad causes in American politics. You were shooting down the good causes. It was gutsy, but is it any wonder that Simpson-Bowles never became law?
No, because we were very specific, and there's no way to draft that those 67 pages into legislative language, although there is an attempt, a bipartisan attempt, I might add, to put the plan in legislative language by the late January and toss it out there and see what they'll do with it. But let me tell you, we got a vote of 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans and 1 independent in our commission. That's, you know, that was 60% of the members, 11 of the 18, to vote for this. People like Dick Durbin, give him an award, from the assistant leader, Democrat from Illinois, Tom Coburn, a very conservative from Oklahoma, And the reason it hadn't been accepted, certainly by the president when we put it in, is because he knew he would be torn to shreds. So he waited because he knew Paul Ryan was going to do something with the mastodon in the kitchen, which is health care. It doesn't matter whether you call it Obamacare or Elvis Presley care or I don't care, it can't work. And in there, we say we won't let it go up over 1% of GDP a year, and we'll do something with doctors and tort reform and people of affluence who can get a heart operation, buy half your studio, and never even get a bill for $150,000. We make hospitals keep one set of books instead of two. We dinged everybody because we knew what the hell is going on. And when you do that, you become a target of emotion, fear, guilt, racism, name it all.
Judy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Alan Simpson. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for taking
good
the
morning,
call.
Good morning.
I wanted to raise a question about the Social Security money coming in from people who are working, and that one very simple way to deal with any kind of deficit, which I think the payroll tax has the potential to do, in fact, is simply to raise that cap from $106,000 of earnings now to higher or with no limit, so that people who are earning a lot of money will simply pay a little more. And it has been clearly demonstrated by many in Washington and out how much that can raise. If you figure it out, it's very simple. I'm not a mathematician, but I honestly think that that is one painless way to deal with any Social Security deficit problems way down the road.
Judy, thank you. And for people who don't know, we stopped paying the payroll tax for people who make more than this over about $108,000 of income. Was it in Simpson-Bowles to raise the cap on the payroll tax?
Sure. I just always say to people, before you, and this lady is tremendously correct, in our proposal, we raised the exposed tax, the wage tax, to $190,000. I, at one time, and I was just out of the Senate and was involved, I said, I think we ought to take that cap off. We had people come and testify that if you took the cap off and exposed all of it to the Social Security tax, that one group of very wealthy people said, well, we would just quit working so hard because we wouldn't want to put in 6.2% of an income of $2.5 million. But anyway, we take it from $106,800 to $190,000. We think that's just what that person who just spoke would want to do. We do stretch it over a bit, but it saves billions, and she's absolutely correct.
Bruce? And it's easy. Bruce in Hackensack, you're on WNYC with Alan Simpson. Hello.
Good morning. Thank
morning.
You.
Senator
Simpson, before I ask you my quick question, thanks for your service to this country. I met you back in Washington in 1986. Thank you for your clarity also. My quick question is, do you think
sure.
President Obama could have been a little bit more enthusiastic about the work that you did on your commission with Erskine Bowles?
Oh, I think very definitely, and the president just last night, I didn't see it, but I had a call. He was on O'Reilly, President Clinton, and they spoke of Simpson-Bowles. I like to call it Bowles-Simpson. He's the numbers guy. I just do the color. He's got the real wizardry. But that is, he said that if he had appointed by executive order a commission of 18, six of them appointed by him, six Democrats, six Republicans, House, Senate, and they had come in with this report like this, where five Democrats, five Republicans, one independent voted for it, he would have accepted it and taken the credit for it. Now, that's Bill Clinton, and that's, I knew he said that. I worked with him. I know him well, always enjoyed him, and worked with him and admired working with him. He never broke his word with me.
So why do you think President Obama, and you are his commission, why do you think he didn't just accept the bold proposals of the Simpson-Bowles Commission and say, here we go, and dare the Republicans to step up and accept the tax increases that were in that, et cetera? Or was it just too hard to stare down some of the president's own constituents?
Oh, sure. His base would have ripped him to shreds. And the sad part to me was that he announced his intent to seek reelection before our report came in. I had hoped, and I think many of us on both in both parties thought, look, once he announces for re-election, his policy people have been thrown into the dumpster. Everything he does now is on the singular North Star, lodestar of re-election, with Axelrod and Rahm is in the game and Foff. These people are there for one reason, and everything from now on, everything, sadly enough, will be directed toward the re-election of the president, and the policy guys are out to lunch.
But I think here's one reason the president didn't bite. Robert in Marine Park, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Hello there, Senator Simpson.
Good morning.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. You know, democracy is the worst system except for all the others. I have a question about the Simpson-Bowles Commission. Now, Michelle Bachmann recently said that her solution to health care would be to make health insurance premiums tax-deductible. They already are. It's my understanding the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommended lowering income tax rates but also eliminating all deductions. Now, I would like to point out, on the basic 1040 long form, the deductions are not just things like business expenses and mortgages and tuition. All medical expenses a person pays out of their own pocket are tax deductible, and premiums you pay on your own health, private health insurance are also tax deductible, not to mention local property taxes, local income and sales taxes. I feel if those deductions are eliminated, a lot of people are going to be really pushed into total poverty.
Robert, thank you. And there you go, Senator Simpson.
I don't see how that can happen when half of the people in the United States don't pay any income tax, and we're giving the lowest group of 0 to 70,000 a tax rate of 8%, and then remembering that those deductions and all those things that in the tax expenditures of the tax code, the 180-plus, are used by only about 8% of the American people, i.e. the wealthy. The little guy doesn't do any itemization. And then, of course, health care, it has to be a certain percentage. You don't get to deduct at all, because if you have adjusted income, gross income is a certain percent, you don't get to any deduction for that. But all we're saying is if everybody doesn't have skin in the game, and if you can't give people the benefit of a tax rate that they've been crying for. But the sad part of it is, if you don't do something with a $15 trillion debt, then the money guys who don't care about the Republicans or the president or the Democrats are going to pull the trigger, and inflation will cut in, and interest rates will go up, and the guy that gets hurt the most is, in the irony of it all, is the little guy and the most vulnerable. I mean, at some point in time, let's quit using that phrase and realize who the hell is going to get hammered when the money market guys call the shots and interest rates go up and inflation goes up. It's the little guy. Come on, let's all listen to each other.
Robert, thank you for your call. Senator Alan Simpson, my guest. What about this summer when the president and Speaker Boehner almost came to a historic grand bargain for, I think, the same size deficit reduction you proposed, about $4 trillion over 10 years, but then the Republicans in the House caucus made him back out. Does your party get more blame, in your opinion, for not being willing to compromise on tax rates at the end of the day?
Well, they may not have been at that time, but I think my party is going to suffer from this impasse right now. But my party is sometimes I wonder about, because if I were running again right now, I don't think I would get the support of the Central Committee, which is 62 persons. The reason? I've always felt now abortion is a horrible thing, but let me tell you, it's a deeply personal and intimate thing, and I don't think men legislators should even vote on it. Where are we on this gay-lesbian issue? What the hell? We all have someone we know or love who's gay or lesbian. What is this homophobia within our party? And what do you always say about Republicans? We want the government out of our lives, the right to be left alone, and the precious right of privacy. How do you equate that with some of these things? I mean, it's absolutely hypocrisy of the first order.
So you wouldn't get the nomination anymore?
I could win. I'd go out around the state, and I'd win because I'd get the support of the centrists and thoughtful, like Adlai Stevens, and somebody said, you'll get the vote of every thoughtful person. He said, that's not enough. I need a majority.
but before you go, I would like you to ask you to reminisce about two things, if you would, from your days in the Senate. You were a senator when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. Do you have any thoughts on his leadership style at that time and what kind of president that indicates he would make?
I'd be very spooked, not because of his personal life. It's what he did, and I watched him, an extraordinary breach of trust. He was part of the Andrews Air Base group in 1990. This was Republican Senate, Republican House, getting together saying, look, this country needs to be reshaped. We've got to do it. Republicans should take the credit. Dole was out there. Newt was out there. Republicans, they met in confidence at Andrews Air Base. And they said, look, we can get two-year budgeting. We can get this. We can get this. It was an extraordinary, sweeping proposal. And they said, but it can't work unless we get some revenue. They went to George the First and they said, George, Mr. President, this is a thing that will solve things and do things for this country, but we're going to have revenue. And George said, well, you know, read my lips is what I've said. But if you guys can do this and you can promise me you can get the votes in the House and Senate, I will accede to that, knowing what it will do to me politically, but I'll do it for the country. And they said, we'll get it for you. And Dole came back to the Senate, and I think the vote was about 60 to 30. It was a good bipartisan vote, and we got it done. It went to the House, and Newt got up on his hind legs. It's anywhere. You can see clips of it. And he said, well, as a member of the group out there, I voted for it, but now as a member of the House, an individual member, I'm going to vote against it, and I hope many in my party will. He took with him Army and DeLay and all the troops. You imagine the glee of the Democrats? I mean, they were just chuckling. They said, it's a twofer. Newt broke his word, and this is the end of George Bush because you read my lips. Go look at the roll call vote of that vote, and you will say to yourself, man, oh, man, this is some guy.
So the point is not his position on taxes, but
not
you
mine.
Think that people would have trouble doing business with him because they couldn't trust him.
Well, I wouldn't, because we were system majority leaders at the same time, and I know him well, and I'm not going to go into his personal peccadilloes, but I'm saying to you, that to me was the proof of a guy that made a promise to a president that dragged that president down, and I think there was a reason, perhaps, for that. I think his minions and his supporters, and they've always been there, they are bug-eyed zealots, I'll tell you that, and they said, you know, Newt, you do this, it's the end of Bush, and you can always say, which he has, and if he responds to what I'm just saying, he'll say, I did that because as I thought about it, I didn't want to put a tax increase on the American public, and I thought all night, I couldn't sleep, and I went back and I said, I don't want to be for a tax increase. I'll just tell the people. And he thought, that'll raise him about 24 notches and bring old George down into the bow wows. And that's the way
he thinks. That's what happened. Have you endorsed in the race, by the way?
No, I haven't. I've got enough problems out here doing my work with bulls. So we effectively think that at the age of 80 at least that I've succeeded beyond my wildest dreams, because I've effectively pissed off everyone in America, and there's still some pockets left, and I don't want to let them know if I support a president's candidate that they can get me.
All right, I'll give you one more opportunity to tick off some other people, because this year was the 20th anniversary of the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. You were on the Republican side of that fiercely divided Judiciary Committee.
Sure.
Just curious if you look back on that and say, we handled that well, we did the right thing, I would have done something different, anything.
Well, that was the worst time of my life because I had a wife and a mother and a daughter, one of whom had been subjected to something 10 times worse than happened with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And when I asked her, what did he do to you? Did he touch you? Did he do this? Did he do so-and-so? And her answer was no. I lost my marbles because I'd had my own personal situation. Those things do overpower your gourd sometimes. But let me tell you, I've talked with Anita Hill since all that happened. And she said, you know, I didn't understand this. She said, how come my friend didn't get to testify, Marcia? I said, wait a minute. Joe Biden was chairman, and when your friend came to testify, she was told that she couldn't by her attorney. And Joe Biden said, get me an affidavit to that effect, because I'm not going to hold the sack that I wouldn't let her testify. I want her attorney to give me an affidavit that he will not allow her to testify. And Anita Hill was quite startled by that. But let me tell you, read her book. I know this is shocking to you. And she said to me, I was manipulated and you were manipulated. Huh. I said, well, how so? And she said, I was manipulated before the forces of abortion, because they knew that Clarence Thomas got on the court. That was the end of Roe versus Wade. I said, I think that's possible. She said, how about you? I said, how about us? She said, you were scared to death. You kept losing votes when you lost Byrd, and the media was beginning to overpower you. In any event, if you read her article in Oprah, she said, remember, this wasn't about sexual harassment. Don't throw anything out there in radio land. This was about, I wanted you to be aware of his behavior. And what was that? They watched porn movies at Yale as freshmen. We never had that at the University of Wyoming.
Sure.
And she felt very aggrieved and offended, and she should have been. The best thing that came out of it is I hope people will give up banging on and whacking on Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill and go back to some charitable endeavor and just know that that was a terrible thing in America, but it did one great thing. It raised the awareness of sexual harassment. And I had a person in my office for 10 years before Clarence Thomas dealing with that same issue. So I don't, you know, it was a ghastly thing for me. But when you have a personal thing that has happened to one of your loved ones and then watch somebody sit there and say, well, I just want you to be aware of his behavior. Yeah. He talked about long dong silver and pubic hair and Coke cans, and I thought, I've lost my marbles. And I did.
Yes. Wow. So last thing, we just have a minute left. What role do you think those hearings played on the road to our current polarization? More cause or more effect?
I think it was a very good thing about sexual harassment, things that, you know, were accepted or laughed about or no longer laughed about. I don't think that was the sweeping change as to where we are today, those things. But I do think that political correctness is like wearing duct tape over your mouth. I mean, if you really are a person engorged with bias and prejudice and hate and pretend that you're goody-goody two-shoes, it's going to come out like a fissure in the side of a volcano. I think half the rage in the world is people saying, well, I've never had an unkind thought about anyone. Ha! Forget it. And I have a definition of political correctness, which I will not share on this family-oriented excursion.
I think we can imagine it. Well, Alan Simpson, you described yourself coming on as now a friendly curmudgeon, but glad to see you're still out there trying to kick down the doors on Simpson Bowls and other things. Thank you very much for spending this time.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to all. I certainly wish that to all of you and the callers. I appreciate that. And, you know, I never had an unlisted number. If you want to find me, I'm in Cody, Wyoming, and I'll try to answer your questions on anything. But before you call me, read the 67-page report, please, because each one of those callers had something to do with something we had already suggested in that report.
Simpson Bowles, online, 67 pages. You can find it. Senator Simpson, thanks again. Merry Christmas.
It's a great pleasure, always. Thanks for NPR. I don't know what we'd do with it out here in the Wild West. We love it.
Thanks again. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we turn our attention to the technological fixes that might get us past global warming. And then with New York registering its 50 millionth tourist of the year last week, we'll see if any of you are out there right now. We will have a call in for tourists at the Christmas season. If you happen to be listening, what do you think about New York? Stay with us.